it's Thursday, the 6th of August. I'm Claire Catford. On today's podcast, the green home revolution that'll mean we save as well as pay.
You might save £400 or £500 a year on your energy costs and pay £300 back on the loan, so it makes sense you actually make money out of doing this.
No money, no football. The Argentinians struggled to kick off the new season.
The clubs just simply couldn't afford to go ahead. They just don't have the money to go ahead. And so the kickoff date, which was originally scheduled for August 14th, has now been shelved.
In other news, shall we stay or shall we go? Why a growing number of migrants are leaving the UK to go back home.
We're looking at cities the size of Portsmouth and Southampton emigrating from the UK. So they came, but now they've gone.
Plus, Facebook, no thanks, it's for the old fogies. It's official, the networking site has been hijacked by the, I hate to admit it, but I'm over 25 generation. But first, a news update and paper review with Bill Overton.
New figures indicate the British economy is beginning to pull out of recession. Manufacturing output and house prices rose, and the service sector yesterday reported its strongest spurt of growth for 17 months. Later today, the Bank of England announces whether it'll continue to pump billions of pounds into the economy. A decision to pause the £125 billion scheme would signal that the bank believes the economy is recovering. A study by the Conservatives claims to show that more than 80% of NHS primary care trusts in England are failing to offer the recommended 3 free cycles of IVF to infertile couples. A Tory MP, Grant Shapps, who contacted each NHS trust, says a postcode lottery operates with rules on age, relationships and other children varying widely, he insists. In some cases, women who would be deemed too old for treatment in one area would be seen as too young by another. PCTs were recommended to provide 3 cycles of IVF in 2004. The US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is due to hold talks with the President of Somalia in Kenya's capital Nairobi on the second day of her seven-nation African tour. The meeting will confirm America's backing for Somalia's transitional government. Much of the country is in the hands of opposition forces, including the Islamist insurgent group Al-Shabaab, and more than 250,000 people have fled their homes because of the fighting over the past 3 months. And company bosses say measures designed to reduce the impact of swine flu on the workplace could end up creating a Skivers charter. More than 1,000 firms have contacted one employment law service to seek advice about staff who they believe are pretending to have swine flu. Now, taking a look at the day's papers and cheery news from several of them, with The Guardian, The Express and The Times reporting Britain's looking at a house prices boom and a possible end to recession. Halifax is recording the biggest rise since the beginning of the recession, and UK car production saw the manufacturing sector achieve an increase in its output. Middle-class millions could lose their free bus passes, warns the Daily Mail, after a report commissioned by the local government association recommended means testing to save councils money. The Mirror leads with a story of a loan shark who escaped a prison sentence after taking £88,000 in interest on a loan of £500. And The Independent looks at the school protection register and claims from the man who helped set it up that it isn't working properly. There are updates on all those stories throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
Could we be in for a revolution in our living rooms? Pay As You Save is a brand new scheme from the UK Green Building Council, which aims to save us money as well as cut our energy consumption. The idea is that the cost of installing energy efficiency measures will be funded through the future savings made on that household's energy bills. Ashley Seeger is The Guardian's economic correspondent.
It would work basically that you would, as a house owner, you would think, I want to spend money on insulation for my house, low energy light bulbs, a new boiler, a solar panel, whatever, up to £10,000. You would go to B&Q or your local building firm or British Gas or whoever, get the quotes, decide who you want to use. The finance would come. They would get the finance. They'd be accredited, these companies. They would get the finance from the local authority, pay for all the work, and then you would pay that back each month with your council tax.
And the government, it seems, want the energy companies to play quite a large role in all of this, but the report doesn't necessarily agree with that.
Well, the energy companies have already played a role in these various systems like CERT, where old people particularly have been able to get loft insulation, cavity wall insulation and so forth done by their energy company. The government thinks, well, they have experience of doing it, let's let them do it. They have experience of billing people, they can add it to the energy bill. The report, though, sort of highlights the fact that many people don't trust energy companies particularly and have been fleeced for an expensive boiler, for example, by a company who I probably shouldn't mention. And so they think that it's better to introduce more and more competition into the business by letting the energy companies bid for the work, but also local retailers like B&Q or local building firms who are good at replacing, at doing double glazed windows or insulation or whatever it may be. They think that if you have the local authority watching over this system, setting the parameters, accrediting the suppliers, you get more competition for homeowners. It reduces the price. The other key point is that by using local authorities and council tax bills have a very low default rate, which means most people always pay their council tax. What that means is the risk of these loans is very low, so the interest rate on them is low, so the householder benefits in that way.
And householders will be able to borrow as much as £10,000 and then repay that. How about the fact that many people will say to themselves, I'm not sure I want to borrow that money, particularly if I have to spend it on energy saving reduction. It's not a priority for me at the moment because there's a recession on. I just need to keep in work, never mind worrying about greening my home.
Well, what the GBC says is that it's pay as you save, is that you would save more in reducing your energy bills, which, let's face it, are likely to just keep on rising in the coming years, than you would spend on servicing the loan. They say a typical three-bedroomed house could save 40% of its energy bills by spending up to £10,000 on energy-saving gear. So, for example, I think the average household energy bill is £1,000 or £1,200. You might save £400 or £500 a year on your energy costs and pay £300 back on the loan. So it makes sense. You actually make money out of doing this. That's the whole point of it.
And if you sell your home or you move on, does the person who moves into your old house inherit the loan?
That's a very key point, and that's exactly what happens. Yes, that would be why you'd have local authorities creating what would be called a local land charge, which would require legislation in Parliament. That's the only slight snag with it or delay with it. But that is the point, is that the loan stays with the house, not with the person. So you don't discourage somebody from moving house. And of course, the person buying the house will think, I don't mind taking over the loan because I've only got to spend £600 a year on my energy bills, not £1,000 that I would have done had the work not been done.
How likely is it, though, that homeowners are going to be quite cautious? Because, of course, the home information packs have been so unpopular. Anything that smells at all like something like that may not take off because of the past.
You're right. That is the concern. And what study after study has shown is that people are put off by upfront costs. They want to green their homes. They want the low energy fridge, the new boiler and all the rest of it. They simply don't have the money actually to spend. And you're right, people are unemployed. They're afraid of things. So this scheme is entirely designed at getting round that fear of upfront costs. Whether it'll work or not, my suspicion is it will for some people. They're planning 50,000 homes a year to start with, up to 500,000 homes by 2020. I mean, this is planning to do a quarter of the nation's housing stock within a decade. It's a big ask, but it's certainly a way around it, I would have thought.
That was The Guardian's Ashley Seagar. For all the latest on this story and other green developments, check out our ethical living blog at guardian.co.uk/environment. Next, they're so strapped for cash they can't pay their top players. The Argentinian football season has been delayed indefinitely because many of the clubs are heavily in debt. The season had been due to kick off on the 14th of August, but the Argentine Football Association has said the situation is now very difficult. Here's The Guardian's South America correspondent, Rory Carroll.
It's not being stopped forever, but the launch of its season this year has been postponed indefinitely. The football bosses in Argentina last night said that the clubs just simply couldn't afford to go ahead. They just don't have the money to go ahead. And so the kickoff date, which was originally scheduled for August 14th, has now been shelved while they try to cobble a deal with Argentine TV companies to see whether they can actually pull the clubs out of the financial hole and get the season up and running.
Now, of course, the Argentinians love their football. How do the fans feel about this?
Well, they're pretty angry, understandably so. And within hours after this announcement, about a group of 100 fans marched on the Football Association headquarters in downtown Buenos Aires. And there they broke some of the windows, they spray painted slogans on the wall, they had megaphones and they were chanting slogans, and they only dispersed after police in riot gear turned up to shoo them away. So the fans are understandably angry.
So there was civil unrest. But what about the players, the implications, particularly for players who've got World Cup ambitions?
Yes, well, Maradona, the team coach, said that he's very worried because he says he's not going to be able to do his proper selection now, because he says, how can I do that? How can I pick the best players if I can't see them playing? And aside from that, the players themselves can't really be match fit if they're not getting any games. Having said that, the Copa de America, the South America's version of the Champions League, Argentina's participation is due to go ahead in that, and Argentina is still due to continue with a friendly match against Russia. But the question is that whether the players are going to be fit enough really to compete properly, and whether Maradona will be able to do proper team selection. So really, it's pretty grim news for the national team as well.
How many clubs will actually be affected, and how many can't pay their players at all?
Well, it's not exactly clear because they haven't all been publishing their finances, but it appears that certainly a lot of the minnows have been very badly affected, and for that reason last week the second division had the launch of its season postponed. But now it's turned out in the last couple of days that even the big fish, like clubs like River Plate, which has won a record number of championships, and San Lorenzo and Independiente, these are the top flight clubs in the first division, are all in dire financial straits, and so they simply can't afford even to pay their players. So it's a pretty grim outlook.
So the resources, they just don't seem to exist. How is that likely to change? I mean, you mentioned television rights. Will the club simply disband, or do you think they'll find the money from somewhere?
Well, they probably will find the money from somewhere. I mean, the two things that really cripple them are that European clubs, and especially the English Premiership, is now no longer paying top dollar, at least this season, for Argentine players. And so this is a major source of funding that has dried up, and that's unlikely to change anytime soon. But my guess is that the TV companies will actually stump up enough cash to get the season back up and running, because the TV company is going to lose a lot of money as well, a lot of advertising revenue, if the season just doesn't take off. And frankly, it's just almost unfathomable to consider Argentina without football. It just, as Maradona himself has said today, it's too dramatic. It's dramático. It's not even really conceivable. So I would guess that somehow, some way, the season will be revived.
That was Rory Carroll, The Guardian's South America correspondent. Still to come, it's not a Laura Laughs, Frank Skinner on comedy's new puritanism.
Comedians don't like an elephant in the room. And not only do they have to refer to the elephant in the room, they have to grab it by the genitals.
This is Guardian Daily. That was always my dream, to return home. Those are the words of one Jamaican woman after returning to her home country from London. New figures show that out of all the migrants who arrived in the UK 10 years ago, only a quarter are still here. Only 2 years ago, nearly 200,000 immigrants to this country moved on. That's a population the size of Portsmouth. Tim Finch is from the Institute of Public Policy Research, which compiled the figures.
The fact of the matter is that there are still a lot more people arriving than leaving in the UK, and net migration has been running at very high levels, and all the projections are that it will carry on being a contributory factor to our population for perhaps many years to come. But what this report has uncovered, I think, is something, a hidden flow, if you like, that a lot of these people, a large percentage of these people, don't stay all that long and eventually leave, and that emigration by previous immigrants to the UK is a big flow. I mean, if you just look at what's likely to be the figures for 2007 and 2008, we're looking at cities the size of Portsmouth and Southampton emigrating from the UK. So they came, but now they've gone. When we look at the number of people who've immigrated into the UK over the last 30 years or so, a sizable percentage of them, around half of them, will have left since that they arrived in this country. And the speed is picking up. People are coming for shorter periods and leaving more quickly.
You've got some very intriguing and interesting case studies. One woman said, her name was Sylvia, when you come home, people don't say there's a black woman walking over there. They say there's a woman over there. We feel at home. That was always my dream, to come back to Jamaica. And it's interesting because, of course, there's so many different perceptions as to why people come here and stay here. And that almost turns it on its head, doesn't it?
One of the things that I think this report does highlight is that very large numbers of immigrants have in their mind to go back. There's a particular group, and a growing percentage of our immigrants to this country are in that group, who are people who are highly educated, highly skilled, and so highly mobile. And then in a sense, they build into their migration experience the idea that they're moving on. So if you think of the Poles who've come in large numbers, most of those, 85% of the people we polled in that group were saying, look, we're only here for a few years and then we're likely to go home. But also, the people from other parts of the world who we, I think, have tended to think of coming to the UK, they've made a big decision and they're going to stay. Now, some of them do stay for longer than just a few years, but in the back of their head is this idea that home is still the original country. And you created someone from Jamaica there. We're finding that there's a small phenomenon, but a significant one, of people of Jamaican origin who may have been in this country for a very long time, but they're still thinking, Jamaica's where I want to retire and indeed die. Some people have said that, you know, I the one place I don't want to be when I die is anywhere other than home. So it's always in the back of their minds that they might be going back.
What about the impact on the political discussions? Obviously, this is a sensitive area for all kinds of reasons, as we've just seen in recent elections. Do you think that this is going to feed some of the arguments that we are being overcrowded by immigrants, or do you think it's going to go the other way? Because people are going to say, look, the picture is not quite so clear cut.
Well, I hope the latter, because one of the things we do draw out in this report is the importance of having balance in it. As I said right at the beginning, there is a much larger number of people coming than going. But even so, a lot of people are going. And I think sometimes people think that that just doesn't happen at all, that all immigrants are coming here, that they come to the UK, they're going to settle, our population just grows exponentially. And I think what we are going to find in future years is that there are going to be more of these people who regard their migration time in the UK as a relatively short one, a discrete period in their lives, and then they're going to move on. And within that context, so much of the migration debate is around how can we limit immigration? How can we make sure not too many people come? In some ways, we're putting hurdles on them arriving and making it more difficult for them to claim citizenship. Well, that might be okay if it's immigrants you don't want, but if they're the young, the highly skilled, which we and other developing countries will be competing for fiercely in years to come, then we may find that as much as an issue of attracting them, it's retaining them. Because if we're just having people who come here and then they're going to move on after a couple of years, we've got to find some more to replace them.
And briefly, the other way around, what about people who are based here going to other countries and then coming back after 4 years, or do they tend to stay?
Well, we are finding that there's this increasing phenomenon of super mobility. And when you talk about circular migration, a phenomenon that's been discussed in the migration field for some years, it's not just sort of in, out and back. It's sometimes and then back again. And people are moving around. I was speaking to someone this morning, a Polish migrant, who was saying that lots of his friends now are saying, well, I've done the UK, but I'm not going back to Poland. I'm going somewhere else. And so these people are moving around, particularly if you've got skills and you're highly educated, the world really is your oyster.
Tim Finch with the latest on those migrant trends. A row over what's funny and what's not has been running for a number of days now, prompted by Guardian comedy critic Brian Logan. He wondered whether a number of comics routinely offend their audience with material that's racist and sexist, using the claim that it's ironic. Intriguingly, two comedians mentioned in his article on so-called offensive comedy said they were offended by it. So should today's stand-ups be more cautious about what they say? Here's Frank Skinner.
That feels to me, which is kind of surprising for The Guardian, it feels a bit like it's a response back to that Jonathan Ross, Russell Brand, New Puritanism, which I felt was kind of championed by the right wing more than, I'm not saying The Guardian's left wing, but it's more liberal left. So I'm surprised at that, really. Richard Herring, I mean, I don't know if I've ever seen Jimmy Carr live, but Richard...
Are you a fan of Jimmy Carr?
I think Jimmy Carr is very funny, yeah, and probably the most industrious comedian I know, and I really respect him for that. I like people who work hard and generate a lot of material. Richard Herring, I think, well, a slightly separate issue, I think he should be a major playwright. Have you ever seen any of his plays? Brilliant. But Richard Herring uses a lot of irony And I haven't read the article in The Guardian, but I've read stuff about the article in The Guardian. And I don't know if the irony was not understood, which I find hard to believe, or whether it was ignored, which might be more convenient for the article. I don't know. I don't know. I haven't read the article. But I haven't noticed any particular change. I think there might be a relaxing of sort of PC taboos in the areas where PC taboos don't matter. And I think when you're doing that, you can sometimes get it wrong and step over the line. I mean, I've never done a rape joke. And I once used the word rape talking about something else on stage. And I felt slightly clammy and ill at ease. And I'm not a very politically correct comedian. And I know that you do get the odd rape joke now, but I don't think that rape jokes are necessarily a change in attitude to rape. In fact, I think that you need a very hard and firm attitude in order to get that slightly horrified laugh from going against it. So I think that it's dangerous to see things that are being said by comedians as true of social trends. Often they are balking against social trends. Not because they particularly believe in it, because comedians don't like an elephant in the room. And not only do they have to refer to the elephant in the room, they have to grab it by the genitals. So I think it's important that comedians talk about difficult and, you know, dangerous subjects. I think you have to be very careful that you don't just hear the subject heading and think, oh, this is bad, they shouldn't be talking about that. You have to actually hear what's being said, I think. But I'm not justifying jokes I haven't heard. There might be jokes out there that are unjustified.
Frank Skinner with his thoughts on Comedy Now. Finally, they are logging off in droves. Social networking sites such as Facebook and MySpace are no longer playing host to 15 to 24-year-olds. The over 25s love them, though, and Twitter's on the up amongst this group. That's what the regulator Ofcom's new research reveals. The Guardian's communications editor, Richard Ray, has been making sense of the facts and figures.
What seems to be happening is social networking sites such as Facebook are being taken over by the 25 to 34-year-olds. And so the 15, 24-year-olds think this is deeply uncool to have either their parents or their teachers looking at their profiles, and they're actually disappearing. They're going, for the first time ever, in fact, over this Ofcom report, it was 55% of 15, 24-year-olds were using social networking a year ago. That's down to 50%. Doesn't sound like an enormous change, but it is a trend which is worrying them.
And also, people do change their opinions of things incredibly quickly. Where are they going, that younger age group?
Well, slightly annoyingly, it doesn't really say. The suspicion is that they're watching a lot more of online television, so things like the iPlayer. They're also probably using things like Spotify, streaming music services. There's been a big explosion in streaming music. What they're probably not doing is Twitter. Twitter's also seen a very large take-up, but that seems to be in that 25 to 34-year-old bracket again.
And is that going to grow? Because there are some people who think that Twitter is a complete waste of time, and some people who swear by it wouldn't do anything else now.
Well, actually, there's a salutary lesson for Twitter and everyone who keeps massively overhyping Twitter within this report, which was, I don't know whether you remember Second Life, which was the big virtual reality world that we were all talking about 2 years ago. Reuters even put a correspondent onto Second Life. Well, Second Life usage has collapsed over the past year. It's turned into a virtual desert. So the worry is obviously with Twitter that it's just going to be yet another flash in the pan.
And it seems to be the case as soon as the oldies get hold of it, younger people think, oh, I've had it, I'm not interested in that at all.
Yes, it gets desperately uncool and they go off and do something else. Well, this is the other thing, that obviously that this report is produced by a lot of middle-aged white men.
Yeah.
So chances are there's actually another social networking phenomenon and site out there that we haven't spotted yet, or certainly the people who write this report haven't spotted it yet. So yes, you better go and ask your kids.
What about the regional variations? Because the trend does show that it depends on where you live as to the kind of service that you use.
Yes, certainly. I mean, there's some obvious ones, like broadband in London is far more used than anywhere else. 78% of households in London have it, compared with a national average of about 68%. And that drops right down in other parts of the country. There's some oddities in here as well, which look a bit strange. The obvious one is social networking is not used at all in Glasgow. Something like 12-13% of people there use
social
networking.
So not a great place to make friends, though.
No, I suspect it's actually because they don't have a lot of internet access. They're lowest on the broadband league at 39%.
Interestingly enough, though, the Welsh seem to be quite intriguing, the figures there, because they love the radio, the Welsh, don't they?
Yes, they're one of the longest list, or the biggest listeners to radio across the country. Whereas television, in fact, is more watched in Scotland than it is anywhere else.
And mobile phone usage, is everybody using the more up-to-date mobiles, or is this again a regional thing?
Well, we're all certainly using mobiles. 80 billion text messages were sent last year, which is insane. That's about 100 texts per month per person. But for specific sort of areas of usage, 3G mobile phones, the new Wizzy ones, are actually more used in Cardiff than anywhere else in the country.
So as far as you're concerned, can you spot the next trend? I mean, you were saying that the white guys who compiled this report, now that's out of date. What do you think is the next thing? I mean, you're twittering already.
So I am twittering, yes.
You have your finger on the pulse.
Yes, well, I think I have my finger near the pulse.
Okay.
I'm actually on it. To be honest, if I could spot the next new trend, I would put money into it and not be doing this job. But no, I mean, it's going to be, certainly from this report, it looks like it's TV on demand. It's watching what you want when you want to watch it for television. For radio, they've really got some problems, and unfortunately, for newspapers, we seem to have some issues as well. The people who took this survey were asked, what would they give up? Obviously, we're in a recession, so cash-strapped consumers, what would you give up first, other than mobile phones and telephony? And gym membership scored very, very highly. Newspapers also scored quite highly. Holidays, DIY, all these things you would get rid of before you get rid of the internet. So if you're looking for a new trend, it is obviously going to be something else online.
That's The Guardian's Richard Ray on who's logging on and who's logging off social networking sites. That's it for today's Guardian Daily. Producing were Adam Gabbett and Harriet Grant. I'm Claire Catford. Thank you for listening.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.